Talk Shoes.
Recorded live.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Pastor Eli James here, and tonight we're going to start over our series on the banking, world of banking, banking usury. With the Bank of England, I'm going to be reading from a document, not the same document I started out with. I'll be working my way toward the story of Barbara Villiers, probably next time. But today I'm going to do more about the history of the Bank of England and the changes that had to take place in England for the Bank of England to be founded, and how England slowly became corrupted by the presence of Jews. All right. So as you know, every country is corrupted by the presence of Jews. As you can see, Germany has, in fact, been taken over by Jews since the end of World War II. Hitler was able to throw them out, but then, of course, they weaseled their way back in and charged Germany for the non-existent Holocaust. And for 70 years now, the German people have been paying through the nose to pay for a crime that never happened. Okay, so what we are doing this evening, I'm going to first quickly read from the Telegraph. I just put the link in the chat room. The Telegraph: attacks on Jews rise to a five-year high in Germany, more than any country in Europe. Well, I'd say probably a percentage increase was in order, because the German people have been oppressed and German culture has been suppressed by Jewry for the longest time. So so they're kind of far behind, actually, the rest of Europe. I'd say anti-Jewish demonstrations are more prevalent in other countries outside of Germany because they don't have the, how should I put it, the Holocaust legal system in place, where people get routinely thrown in jail for denying the hoax. So I'm going to just quickly read this, because this is actually good news that has a, I can try to put this in the chat box again and see if it works this time. Okay, well, I don't know. It doesn't show up on my screen for some reason. I can't post a link twice in the TalkShoe chat box. I don't know if it appeared to you who are listening and observing, but it doesn't pop up for me. Anyway, I put it up earlier, so if you scroll toward the top, you'll see the link. And it shows a photograph of a neo-Nazi from behind, a skinhead, of course, with a nice big old swastika tattooed on his neck, and on his head he's got SS, and across the SS, "Meine Ehre heißt Treue," my honor is true, my honor is true. So you can't have honor in a society controlled by Jews, or in a society that's being taken over by Jews. I think every nation on the face of the earth has at one time or another learned this lesson. But because the Jews are able to buy politicians in every country on the face of the earth, this lesson has been suppressed by Jewish media, by Jewish-controlled education, etc., etc. Anyway, just a few sentences here. It's actually good news that the Jews are finally getting a taste of their own medicine. They're the ones who started all of this massive immigration, anti-white immigration, in Europe, and of course they're doing the same here in America. And it's just a question of time before the Jews start feeling the heat, which they have brought upon themselves by influencing immigration law in Europe. By Matthew Holhouse in Brussels, anti-Semitic so-called crimes have risen to a five-year high in Germany, according to a new report which finds it is recording more incidents than any country in Europe. And I think many non-Jewish Germans are beginning to figure out that the Jews are responsible for the immigration crisis it's pretty obvious that the Jews, you know, control speech and prevent freedom of speech in Germany, and that the Jews are responsible for the lack of open discussion of immigration and other things in Germany. So I would say more and more Germans are turning into right-wingers. He continues, there were nearly 1,600 recorded hate crimes, so-called, against Jewish people last year in the country, the highest level since 2009, and a greater level than recorded in any other EU state. It was an increase from 1,275 the previous year, and it reverses a long-term trend of declining incidents. Jewish leaders yesterday warned of hundreds of thousands of Jews are preparing to emigrate from Europe in the face of resurgent anti-Semitism. Well, that's good. Hooray! Hooray! Leave, but don't come to America. Go to Africa. Don't go to South Africa or Rhodesia. Go to Central Africa or Madagascar. Better yet, go to Madagascar. Nobody wants you anyway. EU officials warned against singling out Germany with the official report by the Bloc's Agency for Fundamental Rights, cautioning that data collection is patchy, with some countries refusing to count anti-Semitic attacks at all, while others are more scrupulous. Nevertheless, depends on how many Jews run the country. Nevertheless, the notable increase in incidents raises difficult questions for Berlin, some 70 years after the end of the Second World War. Now, it's interesting that he invokes the number 70, because remember, it was 70 years since the Bolshevik Revolution in 1917, rather. And 70 years later, in 1987, that agitation for tearing down the wall began to heat up. So there, I think there's a 70-year connection here. So now 70 years after World War II and the creation of Israel, we're starting to see worldwide a reaction against Israel and the Jewish ruling elite. Of the incidents, 45 were classed as violent by the German police. Well, that's only, that's nothing. that's what, not even 5% were violent. So in other words, most of the incidents were probably just people yelling at each other. And the figures suggest the far right still poses a greater threat to Jewish communities than jihadism. Well, we need to have a right-wing jihad, don't we? Some 1,342 of the perpetrators were classed as right-wing, 7 were left-wing, and only 7? You mean there's only 7 left-wing people in Germany who understand what the Jews are? I thought it would have been higher than that. But of course, most of these left-wingers are government workers and university and educational professors. So that they're going to fall in lockstep with Judaism, even though they make noises about, sympathizing for the Palestinians. So only seven incidents were created by left-wingers, and 176 were motivated by foreign ideology, or perhaps foreigners, perhaps immigrants who don't like Jews. Well, most Muslims don't like Jews. So, why are the Jews importing Muslims into Europe? If surely they know this. But, of course, their aim is to destroy the white race. And if a few Jews get caught in the crossfire, that's just too bad. Continuing. However, there was a significant jump in attacks by the latter category, up from 31 in 2013. Unofficial figure. Well, you've been importing more Muslims, haven't you? Unofficial figures from the Amadeo Antonio Foundation, based on press reports, also found a steep increase, with 173 recorded incidents in 2014, a 10-year high that compares to 33 in 2012. So, because all of these false flag attacks, and even Charlie Hebdo was a false flag, even though a Jew, apparently a Jew, died. You know, I can't say that for sure, but the news reports suggest a Jew died. And you know, but they will kill their own, because a bloody false flag has, you know, much more effectiveness than a non-bloody false flag. The figures compare to 815 incidents in France, double the year before, and coinciding with a spate of grave incidents that included marches by gangs in Paris shouting anti-Semitic or anti-Jewish slogans. It is the highest number since 2004, and there were sharp increases in graffiti and vandalism cases, physical attacks, and hate mail incidents. The figures predate the terrorist attack on the Jewish supermarket in January, which deepened alarm. Well, I mean, get used to it, folks. Get used to it, Jews. You're the ones that are responsible for all this. It's called reaction. It's called the reaction. Every host country in history has always reacted against the presence of the parasite. It usually takes 3 or 4 generations. And so 4 generations since World War I. I think we're about there now. And in Germany, because Germany was the main target of both World War I and World War II, the reaction in Germany is occurring a little faster because the Germans understand what's going on. At least they're beginning to. The report notes 2 spikes in incidents across Europe, including the UK, that coincide with controversial Israeli military activity. Well, how about that? Like I said, it's a reaction. Operation Cast Lead in the winter of 2008 and 2009, and Operation Protective Edge last summer. The report found that 7 member states do not publish data on anti-Jewish incidents, while others reported very low numbers. Slovakia had evidence of 2 cases based on judges' reports at sentencing. This lack, now, what is this? You get thrown in jail for calling a Jew a banker or a cheater or a liar or a dirty, stinking Jew, calling a Jew what he is. Quote, this lack of systematic data collection contributes to gross underreporting of the nature and characteristic of anti-Jewish incidents that occur in the EU, the report said. Okay, well, if the Jews keep on doing what they're doing, the reports will increase and so will the incidents. So, folks, this is good. This is good. We need more anti-Jewish incidents all over the world, because that'll drive them crazy, and then they'll start making even more mistakes than they're making already. So let's get to today's topic. I listed it as part one of the history of the Bank of England, and I'm not going to report from the Barbara Villiers episode. I'll start that over again next week, and so that'll be part two. But today I'm going to be reading from a document. I think I posted it. Yeah, I posted it earlier, so I'm not going to try since it won't work. In the chat box earlier, the hidden origins of the Bank of England, and I'm trying to get rid of the it's obscuring. There we go. And obscuring my screen. The hidden origins of the Bank of England from the Barnes Review. By Stephen Goodson. Let me see if I can find the date of the Barnes Review here. No date given right off the bat here. As the financial crisis worsens in America and across the globe, people want to know, when did it all start? Well, it started in, ever since the first Jew started lending money. In fact, the privately owned Federal Reserve Bank in the United States is a spinoff of the Bank of England, established in 1694. And as the Earl of Anglesey presciently observed in 1658, quote, It is dangerous to the peace of the kingdom when it shall be in the power of half a dozen or half a score of rich, discontented, or factious persons to make an accumulation of our own coin and bullion beyond the seas, and leave us in want of money when it shall not be in the king's power to prevent it. Okay, so in other words, the Jews were stealing gold and silver from England and taking it to foreign markets where they could change their money and make profits just by exchanging money, because every single country has its own value for a gold or silver coin, and that's what the Jews were doing. They were taking money away from the British people and using it to money change in India and other places and make a big profit thereby. Article by Stephen Goodson. From A.D. 757 to his death in 791, the great King Offa, which I haven't heard of Offa, O-F-F-A, ruled the kingdom of Mercia. And I think Mercia was like central England, central Britain. One of the seven autonomous kingdoms of the Anglo-Saxon Heptarchy, or Kingdom of Seven. Offa was a wise and able administrator and kind-hearted leader, though he could be hard on his enemies. He established the first monetary system in England as distinguished from the Romano-Celtic Britain. On account of the scarcity of gold, he used silver for coinage and as a store of wealth. The standard unit of exchange was a pound of silver divided into 240 pennies. The pennies were stamped with a star, the Old English stara, from which the word sterling is derived. In 787, Offa introduced a statute prohibiting usury, which is, of course, charging of interest on money lent. Okay, so, of course, we know that the Bible forbids this, and that the Jews refused to obey the laws of the Bible. And we're just pointing these things out as facts, folks. Yeah, they're financial wizards. They're very good with money, right? By disobeying Yahweh's laws, they cheat everybody. That's how good they are with money. And it continues. The laws against usury were further entrenched by King Alfred the Great, 865 to 99, who directed that the property of usurers be forfeited, while in 1050, Edward the Confessor, 1042 to 66, decreed not only forfeiture, but that a usurer may be declared an outlaw and be banished for life. Why they didn't string him up, I don't know. That's what they should have done. Man, if they had strung up these usurers way back when, there'd be many fewer. There'd be fewer and fewer of them today. And on the picture here, okay, this is still no date. Sorry, I don't have a date for this article. But anyway, the link's in the chat box, in the chat room right now. And it gives four portraits of particular English leaders. Alfred the Great, Edward the Confessor, who made the death penalty for usury. There you go, good man. There you go. That's the way to go, Edward. William I, however, was funded by Jewish bankers, and Edward I banished Jews from the realm for the same reason, for being usurers. First, Jewish migration and expulsion. The Jews first arrived in England in 1066 in the wake of William I's defeat of King Harold II at Hastings on October 14th. These Jews came from Rouen, R-O-U-E-N, Rouen, 75 miles from Falaise, where William was born illegitimately as William the Bastard. Okay, so how did he become king? Although the historical record does not indicate whether they promoted the idea of military invasion of England, well, of course they did. They did the same thing with Cromwell. And they did the same with the Moors. They invaded Visigothic Spain. And let's continue. These Jews had at the very least financed it. Okay. Well, if you're financing something, You're promoting it, aren't you? For this support, they were richly rewarded by being allowed to practice usury under royal protection. The consequences for the English people were disastrous, just like Europe and America and all other and all formerly civilized nations of the world, now in total control by the Rothschilds and their usury system. We see disaster on every hand. By charging rates of interest of 33% per annum on lands mortgaged by nobles and 300% per annum on tools of trade or chattels pledged by workmen, within two generations, one quarter of all English lands was in the hands of Jewish usurers. Furthermore, these Jewish immigrants undermined the ethos of the guilds and enraged the English merchants by selling a large variety of goods under one roof. And probably cheap stuff from China. They already had their version of Walmart going in those days. They also played a large role in the clipping of silver coins and the melting of them into bullion and the plating of tin with silver. The famous economist Dr. William Cunningham compared, quote, the activity of the Jews in England from the 11th century onward to a sponge, which sucks up all the wealth of the land and thereby hinders all economic development. Interesting, too, is the proof that even at this early period, the government did everything in its power to make the Jews take up decent trades and honest work, and thereby at the same time amalgamate with the rest of the population, but all to no purpose. Because why? Because, folks, it's in their blood. Hatred of the Anglo-Saxons is in their blood, and that's why they promote usury in all of our countries. In 1233 and 1275, the statutes of Jewry were passed, which abolished all forms of usury. Jewry. Jewry and usury always go together. As most of these Jews could now no longer earn a living, a statute was passed by King Edward I on July 18, 1290, compelling the entire Jewish population of 16,000 to leave England forever. Now, he should have taken time out to prosecute the ones who were robbing the English people blind, but he didn't. Let's continue. Unlike the modern practice of ethnic cleansing, the Jews, after paying a tax of 1/15 of the value of their movables and 1/10 of their specie, were permitted to leave with all their goods and chattels. Okay, so in other words, the King Edward I made a good deal of money by just simply expelling them. However, he could have confiscated their entire estates by prosecuting them and taking their entire estate away. So what he really did was he just sent the cockroaches out the back door, only for them to come back in at a later date. Any Jew who remained after November 1st, 1290, All Saints' Day, was liable to execution. And as far as I can tell, there weren't any conversos or crypto Jews in those days. They hadn't begun to do that yet. Plus, these very rich Jews would have been well known all over England, and they would have not been able to hide, even with a disguise. How do you hide your wealth? You know, what do? You go to a cabin in the woods and set up shop there? No, they left England. The glorious Middle Ages, with the banishment of the moneylenders and the abolition of usury, there were hardly any taxes to pay and no state debt, as the interest-free tally stick was used for governmental expenditures. England now enjoyed a period of unparalleled growth and prosperity. There you go, just like Germany, when Hitler issued his debt-free money, and as many other countries have done. Some of the colonies before the American Revolution were doing this also. issuing interest-free money. Of course, Abraham Lincoln did it too, and that's who Hitler patterned his money from, the greenbacks. The average laborer worked only 14 weeks a year and enjoyed 160 to 180 holidays. And they spent most of that time volunteering, building cathedrals. According to Lord Leverhulme, a writer of that time, quote, "The men of the 15th century were very well paid. In fact, so well paid that the purchasing power of their wages and their standard of living would only be exceeded in the late 19th century." Houston Stuart Chamberlain, the Anglo-German... Okay, hold on. Getting another pop-up here. The Anglo-German philosopher confirms these living conditions in the foundations of the 19th century. Quote, "In the 13th century, when the Teutonic races began to build their new world, the agriculturalist over nearly the whole of Europe was a freer man with a more assured existence than he is today. Copyhold was the rule, so that England, for example, today a seat of landlordism, was even in the 15th century almost entirely in the hands of thousands of farmers, who were not only legal owners of their land, but possessed in addition far-reaching free rights to common pastures and woodland." So in other words, if a nobleman owned a lot of woodland or a huge pasture, the peasants, the free farmers, would be able to graze there as well. And probably they would do some work for the nobleman. So this was a very good form of, well, I don't know if we want to call it serfdom, because they were free farmers. So it wasn't serfdom at all. It wasn't feudalism. But eventually feudalism took over. Let's continue. End of a golden era. During the 17th century, this golden era came to a tragic end. Large numbers of Jews who had been expelled from Spain in 1492 by Isabella I of Castile and Ferdinand II of Aragon had settled in Holland. Although the Dutch were at that time an important maritime power, the Jewish usurers based in Amsterdam desired to return to England, where their prospects for expanding the operations of their money-lending empire were far more promising, of course, using the British fleet. And, of course, there was more money because of the prosperity of the Englishmen, English farmers at this point. They were looking for more sheep to fleece. During the reign of Queen Elizabeth I, small numbers of Marranos, Spanish Jews who had converted to a sham form of Christianity, settled in London. Now, why did Queen Elizabeth allow this? Surely she would have known that these people were Jews. Many of them practiced as goldsmiths, accepting deposits of gold for safekeeping and then issuing 10 times the amount of gold received as gold receipts. That is, loans with interests. Okay, so there's your fractional reserve banking system. So wherever the Jews go, they establish their fractional reserve, issuing fraudulent receipts. So 90% of these receipts were obviously fraudulent because there wasn't that much gold on hand. So this is what they always do, and that's what they mean by fractional reserve. They only keep a fraction of gold in reserve for a potential run on the banks, because these runs on the bank very rarely happen. As long as commerce is proceeding smoothly, a run on the bank never happens. These receipts, a forerunner of the fraudulent fractional reserve system of banking, fractional reserve banking, were initially lent to the crown or treasury at 8% per annum. But according to Samuel Pepys, the diarist and secretary to the Admiralty, the interest rate increased by as much as 20% and even 30% per annum. The rate of interest merchants had paid often exceeded 33% per annum, even though the legal rate was only 6%. So why was Elizabeth allowing them to get away with this stuff? Were they bribing her? like Elizabeth II? Workmen and poor people bore the brunt of these extortionist rates of interest by having to pay 60%, 70%, or even 80% per annum. According to Michael Godfrey, the author of a pamphlet entitled A Short Account of the Bank of England, £2 to 3 million had been lost through the bankruptcies of goldsmiths and the disappearance of their clerks. Okay, that needs some explanation here. Why did these goldsmiths go bankrupt? And why did their clerks disappear? Was it a scam by the Jews? Were they claiming that, you know, they were attacked? Or did they, like Jewish lightning, rob themselves and blame it on somebody else? Cromwell and the English Civil War. In 1534, by the Act of Supremacy, the Church of England was established as the official religion of England by King Henry VIII. During the 16th and 17th centuries, Puritan beliefs based on the teachings of John Wycliffe and John Calvin gained an increasing number of adherents. The Puritans considered the Bible to be the true law of God and emphasized Bible reading, prayer, and preaching, and the simplification of the ritual of the sacraments. Here again, we see that even the Protestant churches were still practicing a lot of Catholic ritual. The Stuart King Charles I, who wished to maintain the preeminence of the Anglican Church, came into intensified conflict with the Puritans. And so did Bloody Mary. Okay, so did Bloody Mary. Okay, I got to find my page just keeps popping in and out for some reason. Okay, ritual, okay. During this, John Wycliffe, okay, the Puritans considered the Bible to be the true law of God and emphasized the Bible reading, prayer, and preaching, and the simplification of the ritual of the sacraments. And, of course, the Anglican Church wanted to do all the pomp and circumstances of the Catholic Church as well. Okay, came into intensified conflict with the Puritans, who were making great progress in proselytizing the entire population. After the assassination of Charles's trusted friend and advisor, the Duke of Buckingham, in 1628, he gradually became more isolated. This growing religious division provided a perfect opportunity for exploitation by the Jewish conspirators. As Israel Disraeli, the father of Prime Minister Benjamin Disraeli, wrote in The Life and Reign of Charles I, quote, "The nation was artfully divided into Sabbatarians and Sabbath breakers." Now, I wonder who's responsible for this artful division. I just wonder who's responsible for this artful division. Did the Jews have something to do with this? Of course they did. All right. In 1640, one of the leaders of the clandestine Jewish community, Fernandez Carvajal, a merchant and spy, who was also known as the Great Jew, organized an armed militia. Oh, he was a filibuster. Or a private military organization like Blackwater, right? Financed by a banker Jew. Organized an armed militia of about 10,000 operatives who were used to intimidate the people of London and sow confusion. Large numbers of pamphlets and leaflets were also distributed. The Jews did the same thing during the French Revolution, blaming Marie Antoinette for all of the problems in France. Of course, she had nothing to do with it. And then they circulated false stories about how expensive her necklaces were and all this kind of stuff, etc., etc. Just like today, Jew-controlled media. Civil war soon followed between the Royalists, Anglicans, and Roundheads, Puritans, and lasted from 1642 to 48. The Roundheads, with their new model army, were victorious, and an estimated 190,000 persons, or 3.8% of the population, died. The leader of the Roundheads was Oliver Cromwell. Just like our American Civil War, it was just another war staged by Jew banksters. The leader of the Roundheads was Oliver Cromwell, whose new model army was not only outfitted and provisioned by the chief contractor and professional agitator, Fernandez Carvajal, but also bankrolled by the Jewish moneylenders in Amsterdam. The leader of the Dutch Jews, Manasseh ben Israel, now sent begging petitions to Cromwell asking that the Jews be allowed to immigrate to England in return for the financial favors which he had so generously arranged. Okay, so he was financed and he got all his equipment from Jews, so he's not a Jew stooge? Of course he is. And a sidelight here, Oliver Cromwell, the Messiah. Above, Rosicrucian Mason Oliver Cromwell. In 1642, when King Charles I of England, the son of King James and brother to Elizabeth Stuart, wife of Frederick of the Palatinate of the Rhine, tried to arrest five members of Parliament for obstructive behavior, the English Masonic Civil War erupted, and Oliver Cromwell assumed command of the parliamentary forces. The Civil War in England ultimately toppled the Stuart dynasty with the beheading of King Charles I. They were among the Cromwellian Puritans. There were among the Cromwellian Puritans some influential Rosicrucians. Oh, am I not surprised? Freemasons, who funded this revolution. Among the Rosicrucians, there were powerful Kabbalistic Marano Jews who had convinced Cromwell that without the spread of the Jews worldwide, the biblical millennium could not arrive. Aren't we hearing the same garbage today? Rabbi Kahn and John Hagee, the same garbage. Absolutely the same garbage today. Okay, so in other words, the Jewish... millennium, the Jewish judgment day. Okay, the Jews have to take over the world for the judgment day to occur. Well, I guess they do. Okay, Leroy, let me see if I can get the link for you again. And I had to erase it from my... I'm sorry I had to erase it. But if you can access the earlier part of the chat, I put it in there. Let me see if I can do it again. It should still be in memory. Yeah, it's weird. It appears in my chat box, but when I hit enter, let me just try hitting the arrow this time. Maybe it'll work. Okay, Troublemaker has it. Okay. Very good. Thank you, Troublemaker. All right, so... yeah, this is from the Barnes Review, a very good article. So among the Rosicrucians, there were powerful Kabbalistic Marano Jews who hired Cromwell, is the proper way of putting it. Cromwell did their bidding by allowing them to immigrate to England. Well-placed Rosicrucians gave Cromwell advanced knowledge of British troop movements. Consequently, he won every battle. So Jewish spies. Later, during his protectorate, occupation by Jews, during his Jewish occupation, Cromwell surrounded himself with Rosicrucian Masons and Jewish banksters. Cromwell promised Jewish representatives that through Freemasonry he would symbolically rebuild for them Solomon's Temple. The Jewish document that Cromwell used to turn Freemasonry into the synagogue of Satan was the Kabbalah. This caused many Jews to consider the possibility that Cromwell might be their Messiah. Almost. Almost, not quite. Okay. In 1640, continuing with the text, one of the leaders of the clandestine Jewish community, Fernandez Carvajal, a merchant and spy, who was also known as the Great Jew, organized an armed militia. Okay, so this was like the a privately financed army. Civil war soon followed between the royalists and the Roundheads. And, of course, Cromwell was one of these Roundheads. Murder of King Charles I. The treachery to which Cromwell descended is revealed in correspondence between himself and the synagogue of Mulheim, Germany. Letter dated June 16th, 1647, from O.C., namely Oliver Cromwell, by Ebenezer Pratt. In return for financial support, will advocate admission of Jews to England. This, however, impossible while Charles living. Charles cannot be executed without trial. Adequate grounds for which do not at present exist. So we got to trump up the charges, right? We got to print newspaper articles accusing Charles of something. And then we can execute him. Therefore, advise that Charles be assassinated. But will have nothing to do with arrangements for procuring an assassin, though willing to help in his escape. Oh, John Wilkes Booth. And Jack Ruby. A reply was dispatched the following. To O.C. by Ebenezer Pratt. July 12, 1647. Will grant financial aid as soon as Charles removed and Jews admitted. Oh, you trust a Jew? If you're going to assassinate somebody, if you're going to do a hit, you want to get paid in advance. Boy, that was stupid of Cromwell. Assassination too dangerous. Charles shall be given an opportunity to escape. His recapture will make trial and execution possible. The support will be liberal, but useless to discuss terms until trial commences. All right, so they trumped up Charles to get charges to get Charles to flee, the recapture, and then bring him to trial. So this was the plan between Cromwell and Ebenezer Pratt. King Charles was staying as a virtual prisoner in Holmby House, Northamptonshire. On June 4th, 1647, 500 revolutionaries seized the king, but then allowed him to escape to the Isle of Wight, where he was subsequently arrested. I wonder if Napoleon was allowed to escape, too. On December 5th, 1648, off that island that he was held prisoner, he may have been deliberately allowed to escape to set up the Battle of Waterloo and the Rothschild takeover of all of Europe. Worth investigating. Because they always follow the same script. On December 5th, 1648, the House of Commons decided, quote, that the king's concessions were satisfactory to a settlement. Cromwell then purged the House of Commons with the assistance of Colonel Pride until there was only a rump of 500 members left, who then duly voted that the king be put on trial. So, in other words, bribing Congress, as the Jews do here all the time. Not a single English lawyer was prepared to draw up a charge sheet against the king. Eventually, it was provided by a Dutch Jew, Isaac Dorislaus. Okay, so they already had their version of international law, like they have at The Hague and the United Nations. So a Dutch Jew wrote up the indictment. The king was forced to participate in a show trial in a high court of justice in which two-thirds of its members were levelers from the army, in other words, paid off by the Jews. King Charles refused to plead, but was found guilty and executed anyway on January 29, 1649. As the procession approached the scaffold, large numbers of the crowd shouted, "God save the king!" After the deed had been done, there was an enormous groan of anguish. Second Jewish migration. From December 7th to 18th, 1655, Cromwell held a conference in Whitehall, London, in order to obtain approval for the large-scale immigration of Jews. In spite of the conference being packed with Cromwell supporters, the overwhelming consensus of the delegates, who were mainly priests, lawyers, and merchants, was that the Jews should not be permitted to enter England. Okay, just like usual, the will of the people is totally ignored once they have their agent in charge, such as lying butcher Johnson, such as federal dictator Rosenfeld, such as the Jew Eisenhower, and the Jewish Supreme Court Justice Earl Warren, and Woodrow Wilson, and all, and of course the two Bushes, and not to mention Barack Jew Obama. Folks, this is such an old story. History is repeating itself again and again and again. Unbelievable. But this is why we need to study ancient history, to show that the Jews do these things over and over. And when will we ever learn? Okay, and of course, the reason they gave, in October 1656, the first Jews were surreptitiously allowed to land freely in England, just like they, you know, surreptitiously landed in New York City. Of course, it wasn't Jewish then, although they still had, Wall Street had already been formed, because Wall Street was the site of the Jewish ghetto of New Amsterdam when it was controlled by the same Dutch people, the Dutch kings. In spite of strong protests having been lodged by the subcommittee of the Council of State, who declared that these Jews, quote, would be a grave menace to the state and the Christian religion, unquote. The merchants, without exception, spoke against the admission of the Jews. They declared that the proposed immigrants would be morally harmful to the state and that their admission would enrich foreigners at the expense of the English. Indeed, same thing with the Federal Reserve Bank. All it's done is enrich the Jewish owners, most of them foreigners, and some of them not even unable to speak English. Cromwell died on September 3rd, 1658, and was succeeded by his son Richard, who ruled for 9 months. Charles' first son, Charles II, succeeded in his executed father, although he would be the last English monarch to issue money in his own right. He made two fatal errors of governance. On August 1, 1663, he passed the euphemistically sounding Act for the Encouragement of Trade, which enabled the export of all foreign coins or bullion of gold or silver free of interdict, regulation, or duties of any kind. In other words, this allowed the Jews to abscond with all of England's gold and silver. 3 years later, by means of an act for the encouragement of coinage, he permitted private persons, i.e. bankers and goldsmiths, to mint the coins of the realm at the royal mint and thereby acquire the considerable benefits of the seigniorage. In other words, a right which was preserved to governments throughout history, up until this point of time, was suddenly transferred over to these Jew banksters. So for benefit of seigniorage income for their own private account. Well, of course, this is why they bribe government officials, so that these officials will pass laws. So this is here again. This is Woodrow Wilson. This is the precedent set by Richard Cromwell. And when Woodrow Wilson signed the Federal Reserve Act, he did exactly the same thing that Richard Cromwell did. His brother James II's reign only lasted 3 years. He was a victim of unscrupulous pamphleteering and propaganda, which emanated mainly from Holland. A military expedition undertaken by Prince William of Orange eventually dethroned him. Although James' army was numerically superior, he was discouraged from attacking after John Churchill. Oh no, not another Churchill. First Duke of Marlborough had suddenly deserted him. Well, very interesting. I wonder if this Churchill was a Jew puppet too. According to the Jewish Encyclopedia, Churchill subsequently received an annual stipend of £6,000 from the Dutch Jew Solomon Medina in payment for his treasonous conduct. Wow. William of Orange's military campaign, like that of the other William the Conqueror in 1066, had been financed by Jewish bankers. In return for their support, William III would surrender the royal prerogative of issuing England's money free of debt and interest to a consortium known as the Governor and Company of the Bank of England. A.N. Field, in All These Things, summarizes these momentous events as follows. 33 years after Cromwell had let the Jews into Britain, a Dutch prince arrived from Amsterdam surrounded by a whole swarm of Jews from that financial center. Driving his royal father-in-law out of the kingdom, he graciously consented to ascend the throne of Britain. Right? No, he took over by force. A very natural result following on this event was the inauguration of the national debt by the establishment 6 years later of the Bank of England for the purpose of lending money to the crown. Okay? For lending money to the government. This is what the Jews always seek to do, is establish a quote-unquote national bank which lends money to governments. They don't care about this, the small fry local banker who lends a few thousand here and a few thousand there to, you know, local people for whatever reason. But of course, they also hate competition. And so that's why they staged the Great Depression, to put the small banks in the countryside out of business, leaving only their big banks, and then changing the laws so that they could establish branch banks in other states, because the initial law in America, folks, was that a bank could not have a branch in another state. So they have to constantly change the law to favor themselves. Okay, the Britain had paid her way as she went until the Jews arrived. The pawn shop was then opened, and the resulting situation in which the nation finds itself today could not be better described than in the words put by Shakespeare with prophetic vision in the mouth of the dying John of Gaunt, quote, "This blessed plot, this earth, this realm, this England, this land of such dear souls, this dear, dear land, dear for her reputation through the world, is now leased out, I die pronouncing it, like to a tenement or pelting farm, England bound in with the triumphant sea, whose rocky shore beats back the envious siege of watery Neptune, is now bound in with shame, with inky blots and rotten parchment bonds. That England that was wont to conquer others hath made a shameful conquest of itself." Richard II, Richard II, Act 2, Scene 1. The history of the second Jewish settlement in Britain is one long trail of parchment bonds shackling the nation in debt. Of course, it's still going on. Every step in the ascent of the Jew in the nation's affairs has been marked by the increase and multiplication of debt. The Bank of England. The need for a privately owned central bank was fronted by a retired pirate, William Paterson, when he wrote a pamphlet in 1693. And no, he didn't retire. he just became a bigger pirate. William Paterson. When he wrote a pamphlet in 1693 entitled A Brief Account of the Intended Bank of England, he would later boast that this bank hath the benefit of interest on money which it creates out of nothing. On Thursday, June 21, 1694. Subscription lists for the bank, which had a capital of 1.2 million pounds, were opened. By the following Monday, this amount had been fully subscribed. And I guess it was all Dutch Jewish bankers who provided the money. In other words, to make a public show of, you know, this is a, we're opening this up to the public, but who's got the money besides the Jews? The ostensible purpose of the bank was to lend King William unlimited sums at 8% per annum to enable the prosecution of war, and in particular the conflict against Louis XIV of France. The bank would thus receive, and I think they were lending, the Jews were lending Louis XIV of France money at the same time. The bank would thus receive from the crown interest of 100,000 pounds per annum, the additional 4,000 pounds being an administrative fee. So they get interest plus an administrative fee. The bank also acquired the right to issue 1.2 million in banknotes without any gold cover. So these weren't even promissory notes. They were simply banknotes. In other words, paper money, fiat money. Prior to its listing, the bylaws of the bank were carefully scrutinized by Sergeant Levins in order to ensure that the bank complied with its hidden purpose, namely, to fleece the English people in perpetuity by allowing the creation of the nation's money and means of exchange out of nothing at interest. So, in other words, I print monopoly money, and it becomes legal tender by decree of the state. And I can spend it into circulation at will because the government has given me the license or the monopoly to do so. Then on top of that, I charge interest on this paper money. And all of it robs the people. Yeah. Yeah, the only expense to the bankster is the cost of the paper and the ink. Now you can see how this usury destroys nations, takes total control of people. And if, and this is since 1694. Since 1694, Britain has been fleeced by these Jew bankers for 350 years now, folks. This is how long this has been going on. 320 years. Prior to its listing, the bylaws of the bank were carefully scrutinized by Sergeant Levins, of course, another Jew. And all this fake money was accompanied by compounding interest. Levins was a Jew from Amsterdam who practiced as an advocate, as a lawyer. There was much opposition to the establishment of the bank. Foremost were the goldsmiths and moneylenders who correctly foresaw that it would bring an end to their usurious racket of fractional reserve banking based on their gold receipts. Well, it would just monopolize the industry in the hands of a few. So even other Jews were opposed to it because it would destroy, you know, their pawn shops would go out of business. Because you now you have a government-sponsored big pawn shop. Landowners and country gentry feared an escalation in interest rates as the bank would control the nation's money supply, and well, they feared. There were allegations that the bank would favor certain merchants. No, it wouldn't favor the richest Jews now, would it? With low rates of interest. The biggest fear was that the bank would grow too powerful and would become the keystone of the commercial world. The same fears that Americans expressed with regard to the Federal Reserve Bank. And, of course, Andrew Jackson had the same problem with the Second National Bank. Unfortunately, this is exactly what happened, as the Bank of England became the model on which all subsequent central banks were replicated. At that time, the House of Commons had 512 members, consisting of 243 Tories, 241 Whigs, and 28 members whose allegiance was unknown. About two-thirds of the members were country gentlemen, and it is believed that of the 512 members, approximately 20% were illiterate. That being the case, how do they vote? I suppose you could just hire a translator, somebody read the bill for you. The bill was debated on July 1694, the high point in summer when most of the rural members were engaged in summer pursuits and the harvesting of their crops, right? The same thing in America. The Federal Reserve Bank was debated while everybody was on Christmas break. Of course, since Jews don't take Christmas off, the Congress was flooded with Jews and their allies. On that fateful Friday, July 27, 1694, when the Charter of Incorporation was granted, only 42 members were present, all of them Whigs, as the Tories opposed the bill. All the Whigs voted for it. This begs the question as to what a quorum consisted of in those days, right? Well, we didn't have a quorum in 1917 either, or rather 1913, but Wilson signed the act anyway. The title of the bill made no mention of the proposed Bank of England, which is only described, or one might say secreted, two-thirds down in the unintelligible verbiage, to the layman that is, of the bill. That's why you hire lawyers. The opening sentence of the bill reads as follows, quote, William and Mary, by the grace of God, King and Queen of England, Scotland, France, and Ireland, defenders of the faith? Really? Defenders of the faith? What faith? The Jewish faith. To all for whom these presents shall come greeting. Yeah, bring your presents. Bring your bribes. The third sentence, which contains 242 words, starts, whereas in and by a certain act lately made in Parliament entitled An Act for Granting to Their Majesties Several Rates and Duties upon Tonnage of Ships and Vessels, and upon beer, ale, and other liquors, for securing certain recompenses and advantages in the said act mentioned, to such persons as shall voluntarily advance the sum of 1,500,000 pounds towards carrying on the war with France. It is amongst other things enacted. So, in other words, the Jews will finance the war against France if they get huge interest in return for all the money that they lend into circulation. The gist of the first two-thirds of the bill details the necessity to levy a complicated array of new rates, duties, and taxes on ships, beer, ale, and other liquors. The true purpose of these taxes is that they were needed in order to fund the interest on all future government, so just like the IRS. You see, our Federal Reserve Bank and the Income Tax Amendment and the Tax-Exempt Corporations Act were all passed at the same time, or at least in the same year, all signed by Woodrow the Skunk Wilson. Same modus operandi. Same old, folks. The Jews never changed their tactics. And, of course, the major tactic is to take control of the media and education so that subsequent generations can never figure this out. It's really quite simple to figure out once you know what their tactics are. So, I own the Monopoly game. I make all the money I want. And so, the other players only get a limited amount of money, and they have to pay interest on it. And the IRS collects that interest in the form of taxes. Can you see that now the owner of the Monopoly game, is going to get super rich and pauperize everybody else? That's how easy it is when you have total control of money issuance. Shortly thereafter, further taxes were introduced, including a land tax, paper tax, poll tax, salt tax, stamp tax, and window tax, which replaced the hearth or chimney tax. Other taxes initiated, well, I guess the people needed to have chimneys in cold weather. Other taxes initiated were, you know, so otherwise you'd be killing people, freezing them to death, and they couldn't pay taxes anymore. Other taxes initiated were a tax on peddlers, a tax on hackney coaches, that is taxi cabs, a tax on berths, Tax on births, marriages, and deaths. And lastly, a tax on bachelors. Wow. Well, now, wait a minute. Whether I remain a bachelor or get married, I still get taxed. Boy, what a cruel world this was. Yes, but you never go to jail. Well, unless you go to debtor's prison. Then you go to jail and you can't get out. However, the most punitive tax introduced was an income tax levied at a rate of 20%. It was applied not only on companies, but on laborers too, just like our American income tax. War and debt slavery. Excuse me one second. Henceforth, a pattern would emerge where unnecessary wars would be embarked upon, which simultaneously increased the national debt and the profits of the usurers. Again, here in America, after the creation of the Federal Reserve Bank, World War I quickly followed. World War II, after that, the Korean War, Harry Truman, Vietnam, LBJ, and on and on and on. Significantly, many of these wars were started against countries which had implemented interest-free state banking systems, just as our wars against the Muslim states, which have interest-free banking systems. As was the case in the North American colonies and France under Napoleon. This pattern of attacking and enforcing the banker's system of usury has been deployed widely in the modern era and includes the defeats of Imperial Russia in World War I, Germany, Italy, and Japan in World War II, and most recently Libya in 2011. These were all countries that had state banking systems which distributed the wealth of their respective nations on an equal basis and provided their populations with a standard of living far superior to that of their rivals and contemporaries, which includes America and Britain. Within 2 years of its establishment in 1696, the Bank of England had 1,750,000 worth of banknotes circulating with a gold reserve of only 2%, or £36,000. On May 1st, 1707, the union between Scotland and England was established, motivated in no small way by the necessity to seize control of the Royal Mint in Edinburgh, which took place in 1709. We unify by force. By 1720, after the conclusion of the War of the Spanish Succession, 1701 to 14, the national debt had risen to £30 million, with the war itself having cost £50 million. After the American War of Independence, 1775 to 83, which had been fought after the colonists were forced to replace their debt-free colonial scrip with English money that resulted in 50% unemployment, the national debt soared to £176 million. And of course, King George III was responsible for that. In 1786, Prime Minister William Pitt the Younger tried to abolish the national debt with a sinking fund which generated interest of £1 million per annum to repay the debt. This scheme was soon abandoned by the enormous increase incurred to finance the war against Napoleon. In 1797, in order to pay for the burgeoning interest burden, a system of graduated income tax had to be introduced. Well, they never simply stopped paying the banksters. I mean, all of the interest they've accrued is all fraud and theft. So why didn't the government ever arrest these people? Why doesn't the government ever arrest these people? That's because the bankers own the government. The war against France lasted from 1792 until 1815. Among the principal objectives of this pointless bloodletting was to destroy Napoleon's debt and interest-free system of finance. Here again, the thought I had earlier that Napoleon was allowed to flee to stage one more bloodbath at the Battle of Waterloo. All of this may have been arranged by the Rothschilds. All of it. On January 18, 1800, Napoleon established the Banque de France as a state bank. As Napoleon detested the bankers, he made himself not only governor of the bank, but also appointed himself first minister of treasury. During this period, England waged war against the United States from 1812 until 1814. This war was instigated by England after the United States Congress refused to renew the charter of the foreign-owned bank of the United States. Of course, it was owned by the Rothschilds, which had been the central bank of America. The first one was not owned by the Rothschilds. They hadn't taken over the Bank of England yet. But it was still Jew banksters, British Jew banksters, which had been the central bank of America from 1791 until 1811. By 1815, the national debt had ballooned to £885 million. This completely unnecessary and unwinnable war, which resulted in approximately 3 million military personnel and at least 1 million civilians losing their lives, cost £831 million, of which over £2.5 billion were still outstanding in 1914. The principal, amazed they were able to pay any of it off. So there's your Jewish pound of flesh. You're talking pounds, billion pounds of flesh. The principal of £504 million increased fivefold as a result of compound interest. Okay, so the principal was yet to be paid. An astute agrarian and parliamentarian, William Cobbett, at this time perceived what was afoot and wrote as follows, quote, "I set to read the Act of Parliament by which the Bank of England was created. The investors knew what they were about. Their design was to mortgage by degrees the whole country, lands, houses, property, labor. The scheme has produced what the world never saw before, starvation in the midst of abundance." Unquote. The affairs of the Bank of England remained secret. And it was not until 1833, 139 years later, that a sanitized version of its accounts was presented to Parliament by means of the Act of 1833. In other words, more legalese, a short version of legalese. In 1800, a member of Parliament, Sir William Pulteney, proposed the formation of a national bank after having made vigorous attacks against the bank. Sounds like our Charles Lindbergh Sr. In 1824, another member of Parliament, David Ricardo, and Congressman Louis T. McFadden. In 1824, another member of Parliament, David Ricardo, submitted a detailed plan to convert the Bank of England into a national bank. Both attempts failed. At the start of World War I in 1914, the British national debt stood at £650 million. On March 31st, 1919, it had increased to £7.43 billion, of which £3 billion is still outstanding after 94 years at a coupon of 3.5% per annum. In World War II, the national debt rose by almost 200% from £7.1 billion in 1939 to £20.1 billion in 1945. That's three times. Currently, it stands at almost £1.2 trillion. So you can see, folks, that no Jewish-owned bank is ever going to do anything but take control of the nation. That's all it's going to do. And the people are kept ignorant and have no idea what's going on. Conclusion. For over 300 years, England has been drawn into the thrall of a ruthless clique of international bankers whose parasitic empire now threatens the existence of this island nation, and not just that island nation, but the whole planet. the once proud people of yeomen and peasants, out of ignorance and indifference, has become a multicultural melting pot of debt slaves. Unless its original citizens take responsibility to familiarize themselves with the true nature of their problem, they are doomed within a few generations to irreversible enslavement and genetic destruction. I'd say a few generations is being too optimistic. I'd say it's happening right now. And there isn't much time left. We have to end. We have to destroy these Jew banks and send all the immigrants packing and round up all the Jews and put them in concentration camps, the FEMA concentration camps that they have built for us. And as they are tried and executed one by one, they have already provided us with their caskets, those styrofoam or whatever they're made out of, plastic caskets at the Homeland Security and FEMA detention camps. So, this is where we're at, folks. This is what the white race is facing in the world today. It's not going to get any better with the current crop of politicians we have. What is the answer besides the second coming? We know that that's going to happen. But what can we do in the meantime? Actually, there really isn't much we can do short of a revolution. And that's why they're constantly trying to take our guns away. But in the meantime, we need to prepare. So everybody who's listening to this message, stash your guns and ammunition. Don't let them take your guns and ammunition, for one. Organize with your neighbors, that is, with your white neighbors, and prepare for the worst. Because what the Jews did to Libya and Iraq and Afghanistan and what they're doing to Syria and Lebanon and all those Middle East countries, what they're doing to these countries, they are already doing to Europe and America and Australia and all other white countries. They're using the same tactics to destroy every single white nation on the face of the earth. Now, it's interesting that China and Japan, who are not being forced to take in non-Oriental refugees, the Jews aren't pushing for them to take refugees, nor is the state of Israel taking any refugees. And China and the Japanese can't be stupid. They see the race war that's occurring in Europe and America and other white nations being instigated by the Jews. They're not that stupid to not see what's going on. So what are the Jews going to do once they have destroyed Europe? They created that monster called China. And the Chinese have no love for Jews, neither do the Japanese. I can see the day coming when the Japanese and Chinese will simply gang up on the Jews and do the job for us. Of course, they will use the excuse to, they will probably attack America and Europe in the process. But the Jews who think that the Chinese and Japanese are going to be doing their bidding, they're going to have a big surprise. Now, at the start of the show, we already talked about the fact that Jews are starting to leave Europe. By the way, this was predicted by the Webbot report of recent weeks. The Jews are going to become very unpopular in Europe, and that they'll be starting to leave. Now, it doesn't say where they're going to be going. I really think they're going to be going to Africa because their money is worth a lot more in Africa. So the conversion rate, you know, from, let's say, British Jews leave Britain with pounds and German Jews leave Germany with Deutschmarks, they can buy a whole lot of stuff in an African country where, you know, the exchange rate is 20 to 1, 40 to 1, 50 to 1, 100 to 1 or more. And so their wealth will be increased just by moving to a country like that. As many Americans who retire to Mexico find out, the U.S. dollar buys way more in Mexico than it does here. So that's probably what these Jews are going to do. So, well, let them go to Africa. Let them go to Africa. But when the race war starts, and actually the race war has started, because it's all over the place in America. And here in Chicago, we had recently a white cop shoot a black teenager who was a known vandal, slashing people's tires in black neighborhoods, no less, and committing all kinds of, you know, lesser crimes, but nevertheless annoying and violent. A white cop unloaded 16 bullets into this black kid. So now the blacks in Chicago are demonstrating against the police department. They're calling for the ouster of Mayor Rahm Emanuel, which would be a good thing, actually. And they're calling for this white cop's head, and they want the Irish chief of police to retire or resign, etc., etc. Now, doesn't it ever occur to these blacks to simply take the guns and the knives away from their teenage sons? I mean, if their aim is to stop the violence, why don't they take the weapons out of their teenage sons? But I guess the parents get a cut from the dope trade. So, folks, and of course, these blacks are posturing like, oh, what, Black Lives Matter? Except to other blacks. Because they certainly don't show any concern for each other in the ghetto. The only concern they have for each other is collecting more welfare. That's the only concern they show. And blaming Whitey for the evil crimes they commit against each other. So, folks, maybe this collapse, maybe this monetary collapse is going to be a blessing in disguise. Only white people will be ready for it. Only white people will be preparing. I'm telling you, the people, you know, my relatives and friends that I've been talking to over Thanksgiving and over the last few years, they're all planting their own gardens, getting their own food, getting water purifiers, etc., etc. They're all prepping. Every last one of them. They're all prepping. They can see the handwriting on the wall. And those of my friends who own guns are not going to give them up. They're simply not going to give them up. And so they'll go down in a blaze of fire. And that's the way it's going to be. So when the economy collapses, that's when the white man, the wrath of the awakened Saxon, will take effect. That's when the wrath of the awakened Saxon will take effect. Folks, the day's already here. You know, Pastor Dan Johns and I have been predicting the race war since 1999. Those were relatively peaceful times compared to today. The race war has begun. It's been actually with us since Barack Obama became president. Some of you who've been listening to my shows may remember I predicted that when Barack Obama becomes president, black people will take that as an empowerment to take vengeance on white people. And that's exactly what's happening. That is exactly what's happening. So, folks, it's time. The best thing you can do right now is to turn people on to Your Folk Radio, where they get more truth from Your Folk Radio than from all other media combined, and that includes the rest of alternative media, which is afraid to use the Jew word, which is totally afraid to use the Jew word. So, you know, they'll criticize the super rich, and some of them will criticize the Freemasons and the Illuminati. But they'll never point the finger at the real culprits. This is what white people need to hear. So I encourage you all to just keep on pointing your friends and relatives to your folk radio, where they get the truth about what's really going on in the world. It amazes me how few people, white people included, who know anything about economics, who have no idea what the Federal Reserve Bank is. They actually believe the Federal Reserve Bank is part of the government. But that's what they've been taught by their Jew-edited school books. It is absolute nonsense. And even there, the Jews are beginning to lose control because all of the, their control of media has been through control of advertising, newspaper publishing, etc., etc. Well, people aren't reading the newspapers anymore because there's so much garbage in them, it's not worth buying a newspaper. So they're giving away newspapers for free in Chicago, the Chicago Sun-Times. They just give it away for free. And they have a free version called the Red Eye. And they still charge, I think, for their weekend editions. And they still charge for delivery. But it's no longer worth it to advertise in such a newspaper because nobody's reading it. So they're losing advertising revenue. They're losing readership to the internet. And when they have, when people have alternatives to Jews media, our stuff is way more interesting than their stuff, right? It's amazing. Conspiracy sells. Put it that way. Conspiracy sells. But the Jews won't publicize conspiracy because they will be exposing themselves. So now that this is the biggest moneymaker, if they could expose themselves, they'd be making money off of themselves by publishing conspiracy stuff. But they can't do that because they don't want to expose themselves. So the Jews are being hoisted on their own petard. We just need to be patient. A little patient goes a long way. Folks, this is where we're at. This is where we're at. Yeah, if Thomas, thank you, Celtic Warrior, Thomas Jefferson should be mandatory reading. Jefferson's wisdom on economics and politics is second to none. And yet, the founding fathers are ridiculed and maligned and or ignored by modern media because they don't want you to know that America was founded as a Christian republic. It has become a Jewish republic. And of course, this was the prophecy heard by George Washington when the British surrendered. I was going to say Mountbatten. I forget the name of the general, the British general who surrendered to Washington. He said within 200 years, America would be taken over by secret societies and become a Jewish state. That's what he said. And it has come true, folks. It absolutely has come true. All right, that's tonight's show. This has been part one of the history of the Bank of England. And next week, we'll get back into the Barbara Villiers story. I'll do a recap of that and get more into the book, which is written by a Jew by the name of Alexander Del Mar, but it's one of the best books on economics you'll ever read if you can get a hold of a copy of it. I think we had there were a couple of online versions available, and so I'll try to find a really good one without a lot of typos, and we'll start over and do a quick recap of the Barbara Villiers story. Thanks for listening. Praise Yahweh. Pass the ammunition. See you next time. Yahweh bless.
Call recording has been completed.